Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled The Evolution of Socialized Medicine, Healthcare Reform Today. Recorded in 1994, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, past president of the American Medical Association and World Medical Association, and author of Code Blue, Healthcare in Crisis, Dr. Edward Annis, and commissioner of the Texas Department of Health, board-certified pediatrician Dr. David Smith, discussed the need for public health infrastructure, tort reform, and the role of effectiveness in government versus market-based solutions. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
In the next few weeks or months or in years to come, Congress will attempt to pass laws which either provide a system of socialized medicine or universal health insurance. Proponents argue that this is good social policy, as everyone in America has a right to health care. Others trace the roots of today's debate to communism, socialism, and the great society programs of the past. Who's right? Now, to present different views, we have two extremely qualified individuals on our panel, plus our usual talented audience members. I'd like to begin by introducing to you Dr. Edward Annis. He is past president of the American Medical Association and the World Medical Association. He has participated in the healthcare debate at the highest levels for over 40 years, including his 1962 televised rebuttal to President Kennedy's move toward socialized medicine. He makes his home in Florida and is the author of this book, Code Blue, Healthcare in Crisis. Dr. Annis, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Before I introduce our next panelist, I'd like to ask you, what does Code Blue stand for?
When Code Blue is flashed in a hospital, it tells the doctors and nurses somebody's heart stopped. And it causes them to immediately respond and quickly, because unless someone is there to start resuscitation within 4 minutes, for the great majority of people, they will be brain dead.
Okay, and you think that's where we are in healthcare in this country?
I think that Code Blue alerts you that there is a crisis, that something must be done. But then the next problem is it should be done properly by people qualified to know what to do and how to do it. So the title is merely to get people's attention rather than say that it's the solution.
Thank you. Sitting next to Dr. Annis is Dr. David Smith. He is commissioner of the Texas Department of Health and a board-certified pediatrician. Previously, he served with the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington, D.C., and is a nationally known proponent of health care reform, which encompasses prevention and ensures universal coverage. Dr. Smith, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Let me begin by asking you this. What are the essential elements of what health care reform really ought to look like?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer, but let me make about 6 points if I could. The first, actually, though, before I go into those, is that my one worry is that in this whole debate, we're polarizing the issue, quite frankly, away from the patient. So often, the only person that hasn't been at the table in debate has been the patient. They're the only one that can't afford a PAC or someone to represent them. And so when you talk about socialized medicine, it often polarizes the debate again where it shouldn't be and leaves people out of touch with the issue and quickly says, I don't want to pay attention to it. Let me talk about 6 elements that I think are important regardless of how you get at it through the financing mechanism.
Do it.
Number one is universality. I think it's essential, and let me just make a point for each because I don't really want to go into detail. Number one, with universality, it is an issue and we need to do it for several reasons. One is, right now, we're all paying for those that don't. It's much better to have it in a mechanism where people are covered and we don't cost shift.
But you mean, when you say universality, do you mean universality of insurance coverage or universality of health care?
Universality of health care, which also includes access, not just a financing mechanism. Most of the debate before this point in time has been around primarily the financing issues, not about what kind of care, where it should be delivered, and do we want to, in fact, change our philosophy towards something like prevention. On universality, the point that I think is relevant to this state and the country is that the largest and fastest growing group of uninsured right now who then have difficulty with access are children. Most of those kids are middle class. We know that, in fact, 86% of those kids live in a home where the head of the household works and themselves has insurance coverage. This refocuses the debate. No one's saying it very well, but you got to be willing to look a kid in the eye and say, I'm not in favor of universality, therefore I'm not in favor of you having access to health care. That's a critical point. Number two has to do with administration. We have obviously more forms than we have body parts. We need efficiencies here. I believe that that is part of the debate. I'm not sure it can save as much money as everyone believes, but it could make practice a whole lot easier for a lot of folks.
Administration is a problem because so many insurance companies have different forms, or because the government requires so many forms to be filled out?
Actually, it's both. We have over 1,500 insurers in the state of Texas. Unfortunately, when I graduated from medical school, my family was hopeful that I could interpret all of those and understand all the co-pays and deductibles. I didn't have that class.
Yeah. You missed that in
I
school.
I missed that one.
It wasn't one of the things that pediatricians did.
And it disappointed them.
They're probably teaching that today, I would assume, aren't they?
Perhaps. I don't really believe all are doing that either.
Point three.
Point three has to do with a philosophy pointing towards prevention. Let's put some logic into the current system. Right now, we're paying later. We're paying for things such as strokes after they've occurred. We'd much rather, quite frankly, pay for your blood pressure medications or not pay for your blood pressure medications and pay for your stroke. We'd rather pay for an amputation of a diabetic than the insulin or the insulin syringes. We'd rather, up until recently, pay for an admission with measles pneumonia than for the measles vaccine. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make a lot of sense.
So you're saying it's like the old Fram oil filters,
correct.
Pay me now or pay me later.
That's
You'd
right.
rather pay me now.
People will also argue, and I think Dr. Annis has done this, that it may not save money way out because people may live longer. But there's a quality of life issue on this debate of prevention. And no one has weighed what the productivity on the business force may be if you're healthier and your functionality is better on the job site or you're attending school. Point four has to do with public health. We can't forget in this debate the operative word should have been health in healthcare reform. Most of the debate is around medicine and curative aspect of medicine. Not, again, the preventive aspect or the fact that in states such as Texas, and it's true in many states, we're still dealing with the biblical diseases, plague, TB, leprosy, and rabies. We don't even call it leprosy anymore. We call it Hansen's disease, so you don't get scared. We have resurgence of tuberculosis throughout this country. So someone's got to remember about food, safety, and water, and these resurgent diseases.
Okay, well, let me stop you on that point for just a minute, because I think we had talked before the program, and Dr. Annis, you had talked here, too, about the public health situation. Maybe I can ask you, Dr. Annis, to explain to the people watching the difference between public health and sort of medicine as we typically talk about it.
Well, of course, public health is basic water, food, and the protection of the public by virtue of good public health, which includes engineering and all of the other things that go with it. That's basic, and it starts with education.
Okay. And Dr. Smith, you're head of the Texas Department of Health, and your job should be looking after those sort of global issues, but you find yourself being lost in the debate somewhere or else doing other things. Is that true?
That's correct. In fact, because of the holes in the current system of coverage, we often try to get a ragtag group of clinics and things open to try to see people that don't otherwise have access or insurance, when indeed what our real purpose, and this is one bureaucracy, by the way, that should get smaller in reform, which is amazing for a bureaucrat to say. But if you do it right,
Would you say that again, just so the cameras?
Sure. And I'm not running for office either here. I'm hired. But the point is that if you do it right, many of my programs fill in the gaps. I have a kidney health program, an AIDS program, a tuberculosis program, a prenatal program. All of these little widgets we put people in, but we don't cover the whole person. They should go away if we cover the whole person.
Okay, but you've just been appointed to a national commission that has to do with vaccination. Part of what we're talking about
mm-hmm.
here?
That's correct. That's another public health issue where we will always have a role to make sure that we're there for disease outbreaks. But even vaccines should be much better administered within the private sector and make it easier for those office-based settings where you can have a home which has constancy of provider. In other words, you see the same doctor.
Okay, number five.
Number five has to do with the need for infrastructure. In the state of Texas, and it's true in other parts of the state, an aspect of reform is anyone out there going to accept this new coverage, public or private, are they there? In many states, we have many parts of the state where there are no providers. In Texas, 170 counties have a designation called, they're basically saying they're underserved. And what's true of many parts of rural Texas and inner cities, the only constant in Texas is Dairy Queens. And unless they're going into business of health care, we don't have anyone out there.
And it's not just in Texas, it's all over the
country,
especially in rural areas. Is that
rural,
right?
Well, actually, it's true in both inner city and rural. It's not isolated to the rural problem.
We like to be in the suburbs where the doctors can do better and see higher quality patients in many cases, or at least higher income patients. I don't know if the quality is any better.
Right. And let me give an example in Dallas, since we're here tonight. In Dallas, one part of southern Dallas most recently had only one primary care physician for 122,000 population.
Wow.
That's under service. So again, you can talk about the financing and are we going to pay for logical things like prevention, and is anyone going to be there, and are they culturally competent, and do we have the primary care folks in place?
Good
real
point.
Issue.
Good point. And number six.
And the final one has to do with outcomes and accountability. I think you made the point earlier, and that is that we may not get it perfect this time. And what I think business community is beginning to ask is, are you guys going to be accountable for anything? Are you going to, in fact, improve death rates from cervical cancer, which is preventable? How about workman comp claims? Because if you're doing a healthy thing, fewer people ought to be taking it. And what about functionality on the job site, performance and school attendance? I think we're going to have to be more accountable under reform, because we probably will test some things to see if they work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think accountability would be nice. I think the taxpayer certainly has seen something less than that in some cases, and I think people dealing with private insurance companies have too from time to time. Thank you for that perspective, those 6 points. And Dr. Annis, if I could then impose upon you to give the viewers a more of an historical perspective on this issue. I think that many people watching this program sort of think that, and we're taping this in July of 1994, that in the next 3 weeks, the Congress is going to throw together some bill that, and I doubt that anybody will be real pleased with it. Maybe they'll put something together before the elections this fall. But we're looking at a broader perspective. How did this whole national health care debate come about? Government involvement in health care, is that a good idea? Should we have more of it? Should we have less of it? What should we do? And regardless of what happens this fall, we want to address those issues for the future. Let me then read from page 6 of your book, Code Blue. And here's what you say. The philosophical flaws of the Great Society have festered, and the politicians who created the problems, with the aid of a biased and belligerent news media, I'm sure this program is an exception, are pointing fingers in all the wrong directions. They are mounting a final assault on common sense in an effort to gain complete control over the provision of medical care in America, and ultimately, to bring about the rationing of life-saving technology and patient care in order to force medical costs down. This is the only way they can retain and, in fact, greatly expand governmental power. And then you conclude by saying in this paragraph, the truth is that the problem is government, not health care. Let the record reflect that he's from Florida and these people are not, so they couldn't be a pumped up audience, but obviously somebody agrees with you. In the time that we have here, give us a little bit of historical perspective about where you think this issue came from, how we got to where we are today with government involvement in health care, and whether you think that's a good idea or not.
Well, I was introduced to it as a young physician, and at that time, a bill was introduced into the Congress known as a Wagner-Murray-Dingell bill, the current Congressman Dingell's father. And they wanted to bring to this country a method of government providing health care comparable to what they had in Great Britain, with government owning and controlling the hospitals, the doctors and nurses primarily being employees of the state. That was presented to the American people, and at that time, the American Medical Association came forth with their basic philosophy, which hasn't changed. And from the time I was a young physician and long before that, and that was a while ago, our attitude and our policy has been that anybody in this country who needs medical care should have it when they need it, as long as they need it, whether or not they can pay for it. But we also believe that the great majority of our people who provide for their own food and clothing and housing and transportation and recreation and fun can, through the mechanism of good insurance, provide for themselves and their loved ones. Then all of us together, through government, can take care of that segment of the population unable to take care of itself.
Okay, now let me stop you there for just a second. The health care service, the public health system, as David Smith is involved in, you would see that as a legitimate form of government?
Not only legitimate, but fundamental.
Okay.
If you don't have good public health, you don't have good health. You don't have the background. And doctors are constantly dealing with the problems that come as a result of poor public health. We're seeing it nationwide today on the television every day. When you see the plague and the children dying every hour, this is because they don't have water that's safe and the other things that go with it.
And the things that are happening in Rwanda presently. Okay, go ahead.
So Wagner-Murray-Dingell was defeated. The American people didn't want the system that they had heard about in Great Britain. It quieted down for a while and came back up. That was in the 40s. In the 50s, it was the Ferran Bill. But the Ferran bill was structured so that they were going to pay surgeons and hospitals, but they weren't going to pay the rest of the doctors. And some of the reasoning then was, if we begin to pay those that are just those guys that are the cutting doctors instead of those that use their head, pretty soon all others will want to be included. It'll be easier to do it. This too was opposed, and rather successfully. Then came the big drive a few years later in the early 60s for King-Anderson. King-Anderson legislation is known today as Medicare. My introduction, along with many other doctors, was in our opposition to what became known as Medicare. But our opposition was based very similar to the basic philosophy that I enunciated, and that is that people able to provide for themselves should do so. They shouldn't be provided by government regulations through taxes. When I argued at that time against a policy that would give immediate entitlement to everybody just because they had a birthday.
So, and what age was it at the time? 65?
At that time, they took 65. Now, at that time, when Medicare was passed, there were 16 million people over the age of 65, including my mother and dad, both of whom had their own insurance. I remember the day when my mother called all upset because she'd been notified from the insurance company they were canceling their insurance as of the end of June. She said to the insurance man, "What do we do? Where can we get it?" He said, "You can't. You have to take Medicare or you won't have insurance." Mind you, they were among the 7.7 million of the 16 million who were paying for their own insurance. They immediately became entitled to health care coverage to be paid for by younger working taxpayers. Now, at that time, there were 15 workers paying taxes for everyone over the age of 65. Today, the last figures out of Washington some 6 or 8 months ago was now there's 3.4. Less than 4 workers are being taxed for every one of us over the age of 65 who are entitled to coverage to be paid for by the government. This is where the problem has arisen, and this is why today, one of the major problems we have, and one of the reason for the tremendous increase in cost to the private sector. Medicare isn't paying what it costs to provide services. Medicaid isn't taking care of what it promised to take care of the poor. Now, if our government can't take care of the elderly and the poor as promised, how are they going to take care of 258 million people?
Right. I want to let Dr. Smith respond to that, and then I want to show you a graph that kind of shows who actually pays for health care in this country right now. Dr. Smith.
Well, I've had a chance to look at Dr. Annis's book and review some of his works. The problem is, again, though, we tend to polarize this issue and leave the patient. Kids don't work, first of all. Many of the ways that people are proposing to pay for this have really not taken them into consideration, and a whole lot of other folks that are down and out, or even people now being laid off from the military. One of our greatest new businesses, I'm afraid, in this state is laid off military. And all of a sudden we've characterized these individuals who are no longer able to provide coverage as someone who doesn't care, who we don't want to work with, and we create again another stereotype or soundbite about them. Let me lay the other side, because I think the truth is always in between. Government has inefficiencies, but again at the same time, let's talk about insurance for a moment. 1,500 insurers, 30,000 plans in this state alone. Average administrative overhead, 24%. Many of the small plans taking 47 cents of your premium dollar to manage them. True. Now, do you like that either? Well, what's the overhead in Medicaid? 2.8. Let me be truthful about it. Too low. Why? We use the lack of having automation and putting restrictions in because we don't have enough folks to work it. We keep people off the rolls so we save money. The truth, again, is in between. And what happens is we want to polarize this to the government or into the private sector. The truth is we've got to come together to get some commonality. And let's get back to what's critical. It's the patient and the person that doesn't have coverage that indeed does not have access. And in fact, we do ration care in this country.
Okay. Dr. Annis, in your book, Code Blue, one of the things that I will never forget is you said when you first began practicing, and for many years, that you and other physicians like Dr. Smith and many of the people in our audience sometimes spent as much as 20% of your time dealing with the indigent, with people who could not pay. And today, the typical healthcare provider spends that much of their time filling out government forms. Is that true?
Those are the figures. You see, Dr. Koop, former Surgeon General, on the McNair-Lehr report, this was 8 or 10 months ago, or a little bit more than that now, he reported then that the cost of rules, regulations, and paper dictated by governmental policy through the bureaucracy of HHS. It approximates 26%. This study also was reviewed in by Harvard just for 3 or 4 months ago, and there's several similar figures. Mind you, if you took all the doctors in the country, the good ones, the bad ones, the avaricious few, and put them all together, and what you pay them is less than 19 to 20%. Now, imagine, if it takes 20% to pay all the doctors in the country, how can you justify 36% for rules and regulations and the horrendous, onerous, suffocating things that doctors are putting up with every single day?
Okay, let's look at this graph and see who actually pays the health care claims today. So if you look at this, you will see that back in 1960, it appears that health insurance companies were paying about 20%. That's up to almost 30% of the total spending on health care. At that time, in 1960, only 34 years ago, about 60% of the total health care was paid for out of pocket, so that the individual who got the health care had some control over it. They apparently went to a doctor and said, you know, here's, you know, what are you going to charge me, and that sort of thing. And then government was only paying something around 20% as well. Now, if you look at 1960, it starts down a bit from 60 to 65, and then in 1965 or 66, starts going up, and the percentage of total spending on health care has doubled in government, while it has dropped more than half in individuals, and insurance has gone up just briefly. Is there any, I'd like for the two of you to kind of respond to that. Dr. Annis?
Well, That graph points out the fundamental problem we have. The great majority of the American people, when they go to the doctor or hospital today, don't ask in advance how much will it cost, because someone else is paying the bill. If someone else is paying the bill, it's easy to spend it. In all my many years of active practice, and for 10 years I was chief of surgery of the largest private hospital in Miami, Florida, in all those period of time, I don't think I had one patient out of 50 if they had a hernia or a gallbladder or a cancer or a thyroid, they wouldn't say, Dr. Annis, how much is your fee? And I would tell them the regular fee. They might say, look, I'm a laborer, I'm a bricklayer, I'm what? And you'd adjust the fee up or down. You'd let them pay $10 a month, $20 a month, anywhere they wanted to. But the point is, they always ask. Then they would say, how much is the hospital bill? And we could tell them how much for surgery was the first hour and how much every 15 minutes after that. But when they went in, they knew pretty much in advance. Their insurance only took care of things that were insurable, didn't take care of ordinary maintenance, the hernia, the heart attack, the stroke, the tumor, the cancer. They knew how much the insurance would pay, so people knew. Today, wherever I go, I ask doctors, how many of your patients in the last week or the last month have asked you, how much is it going to cost? And they have to stop and think, you know, they don't ask. They don't ask because they have insurance that someone else, they really pay for it. That's a part of their wages, but it goes through their employer, and they don't pay for it directly, or they get it through government programs. And if there's any one thing that I think is horrible in this country, it's the Medicare and the Medicaid areas, the mills that they've had around the country, taking advantage of the fact that neither the doctor nor the patient realizes the kind of money that's being spent there, because they neither one of them see it.
Dr. Smith, would you agree on that or not?
Well, not totally. Number one is one of the important government spending areas that we haven't spent any time with, and I'm sure we don't have time, has to do with expenditures in long-term care, which is really one of the fastest growing areas, and it's often included in that health care figure. The other is you'll see that actually the decline in out-of-pocket has leveled off as we've hit the last 4 or 5 years, and you'll see that curve flattening, which means a trend is occurring. I would actually agree, though, that one is that the individual needs to be aware of what it costs. I think that's a good informed consumer. And the employer or anyone else involved should know, and they should also know whether or not what they're covering is successful.
Right.
The final point, though, has to do with the fact that we ought to look at some programs, I think even like vouchers and others down the road, but for some it won't work because they don't make enough. I don't care how you structure it, it still gets back to the kids' problems. There are no uniform magic wands in this. Everyone's looking for one, and I think we've got to quit doing that, particularly when we look at how diverse the population is and who's affected.
Thank you.
I want to focus this debate on what everybody agrees is a problem of the middle class. The poor have the government and the medical industry that had traditionally taken care of the poor. The rich have always been able to take care of themselves no matter what. But the focus is on the middle class families. That's where it's at. I'd like to ask one very basic question, though, in a framework of right now, today, more than half of everything that every parent makes goes to pay for bureaucrats. And less than half of what they make goes left to pay for their own families, for their own children. I want to ask a very basic point. Who deserves more, children or the bureaucrats? And unless we come to grips with that and end up putting 1/7 of our economy into the hands of the bureaucrats, then we're going down the wrong road. And everybody that wants to do this in terms of health care reform is shortchanging children, period.
I think you raise a legitimate question, and it's part of this debate. I would also flip it by saying, though, you're putting far more on the administrative side into the private insurers and others who administrative costs are much higher. If you're going to be fair about the criticism, be fair in both directions, which often we are not in this debate. We have not been. We like to pick on the bureaucrats. The other point I'd like to make, and it has to do both, since I tend to resemble one of those folks, is that where are you in all of this? How active are you in determining expenditures? The bureaucrats in most expenditures in state governments are in three areas: prisons, education, and Medicaid. And most of that, per recipient, is long-term care. So please define what it is that you're arguing when you throw the term bureaucrat, because we are they. We are all part of that government, and it's easy to make it that third person issue because it's a cute thing and it's a soundbite. But also realize we've got the same inefficiencies on the private side.
Okay, I want to ask Dr. Annis about this particular aspect of the argument, because Dr. Smith makes a very interesting point about the money that's spent by private health insurers through administrative claims. You alluded to it just briefly a moment ago, and I want to go back to that. You were talking about, I think, the difference between insurance and maintenance. So could you explain to the viewers who are watching this program how we've perhaps gotten off the track with what is insurance and what is not, and how that would lead to exceedingly high costs of administering a lot of small claims?
Well, may I give you a couple of just simple illustrations? Insurance is based on the principle of risk. For example, in a city like Dallas, in any one year, a certain number of homes are going to be partially or completely destroyed by fire. It'll be a small percentage. Everybody can pay a very modest amount for insurance, for fire insurance, and then when the person who does suffer is there, the insurance is there to cover it. That's real insurance. However, how much would your homeowner's insurance cost if every time you called the plumber or the electrician or had to fix a leak in the roof, or wanted to repaint your house, you said the insurance will pay for it? That's not insurance, that's maintenance. Now if you, and that's the way life, health insurance used to be. You got an indemnity, you knew if you had a heart attack or a stroke or a cancer, you knew what it would cover, and you knew how much it would cover. You knew that in advance. But you knew also it wouldn't cover if you go to the doctor for a cold. Now if someone else is paying the bill and you don't feel well, go to the doctor. If you have to pay it yourself, you'd use good judgment. You'd take grandma's advice and go home and take chicken soup. You'd get well just as quick as if you went to the doctor. But if someone else is paying the bill, that's the danger. Imagine how much automobile insurance would cost if it covered every time that you bought gas and oil, if every time you had to have the car taken care of, every time you had to get new tires or a new battery, they say insurance will cover it. They'd say, wait a minute, everybody has that. That's the kind of exposure that you get in automobiles as they get older. You can't insure against those things. You can, but it would be horrendous in cost. And in medicine, if we get back to the principle of insurance, take care of the things that are really costly. That's what the great middle class needs in this country. Only about 5% of the population at any one year have a major medical or surgical problem that costs up into thousands of dollars. 95 out of 100 don't. They have the 50, the 100, 200, 300, and the insurance companies, and you're so right on the figures and the amount. It costs an insurance company for a $50 bill another $50 to process it. And so billions of dollars are spent on little claims rather than in the big claims of real insurance.
Why has that happened? Talk to us about mandates.
It's been a gradual thing at the state level. For example, in the state of Florida, if you were an insurance man or a woman selling insurance, in your policy that you would have to buy, let's say you're a young single person just out of school, just getting going, you want to have coverage and you have to buy it. You got to cover the MD, the osteopathic physician, the chiropractor, acupuncture for a certain amount, massage therapy, counseling. You've got to cover all of these things, whether you want it or need it. That's mandated by the legislature in the state of Florida. We have similar mandates across this country, almost 900 of them. And so what's happened is insurance companies have been forced to move in more and more into the area of maintenance. You know, in one state, I could go to, if I got a psychiatrist to say that I suffer emotionally because I'm bald, I could get a psychiatrist to say that, and I could get a free hairpiece under insurance. That, and everybody in that state has to buy insurance that would cover hair pieces if I could get a psychiatrist to say it would greatly improve my psyche. And it might.
Unbelievable, Dr. Smith.
Well, a couple of comments about it. We probably disagree on some of this maintenance issue, because I think you put the incentives for the patient and the providers to do the prevention, and you actually make the copay if they're using the emergency room inappropriately for a cold. That's where you build in the incentive or the disincentive on both sides. Let me talk for insurance just for a second, because health insurance, by the way, was developed by who? Hospitals, historically, even back beyond what Dr. Annis talked about. Historically, insurance companies were developed by hospitals. Why? They wanted to fill their beds. We really haven't changed that philosophy. By the way, the other reason that there's such costs in insurance is not just this issue, by the way. It has to do with profit margins and utilization review that have nothing to do with state mandates. In fact, I've seen, and I now have Medicaid, which has caused my Maalox supply to increase in the last several months. But what we've found, which is amazing to me, is I've had a number of docs say, I'd rather deal with you than the 1,500 insurers. So again, the truth is somewhere in between. And we've got to be careful to not go with the sound bites, because again, you're going to lose the focus on what's important in the patients in this debate. And I'm afraid we do that all too often, and that gives the Congress folks up there on both sides of the aisle a way out, and we're giving it to them.
We don't want to give them a way out. I want to give this guy a way in, however.
One point that I've never heard mentioned in this whole debate is the fact that under the rules of running our government, which is in our Constitution, by the way, the federal government has no authority at all to spend a penny on health care, or sick care, I like to call it. Someone once made a comment to me, I'll never forget, that if the federal government took over the administration of the Sahara Desert, we would run short of sand. All you have to do is look back at the history of federal government programs, war on poverty, for example. In 1965, it started. 30 years later, 4 out of 10 Americans get food stamps, worse than it's ever been. When you want to increase something, you subsidize it. Canadian bureaucrats in the Canadian health care system come to the United States when they need immediate health care. If they wait too long up there, they will die. I've read of this, of cases of this. Also, anybody in this country has access to medical care. Parkland Hospital, an example. I have never heard of anybody that's been turned down medical care. You may not get the best money can buy, but it's available.
Okay. Dr. Smith, you are shaking your head at that. I'm going to, because you were at Parkland for a while, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to that. But first, I'm going to use one of my favorite cliches. I wish I had made it up, and it goes something like this. If it moves, tax it. If it moves too fast, regulate it. And if it doesn't move at all, subsidize it. I couldn't resist that. So go ahead and respond
well,
to the comment.
It still gets back to the soundbite issue here that we're involved in. We could go in a long debate over the Canadian system. A lot of it is what you read in any kind of press you want. I will use the ultimate anecdote since other use. I have two 93-year-old grandmothers. One lives in Ohio and one lives in Ontario. One of them is happy with their health care system and one is not. And one has home health care. One has prescription. One is, in fact, gives incentives to stay in the home so she has to pay her taxes, and it's not Ohio. Now, I can come up with the same kind of stories that you can, and we can counter that back and forth. Canada's got some significant issues. They're overbedded. They've got long-term care hooked to their hospitals, big expense drivers that you would never want to repeat. But you've got to be careful in this debate because it's too easy to soundbite it. And you all like doing it because it makes headlines, but it does not get people covered and it doesn't get them health care.
Dr. Annis.
Canada's percentages are much like ours. Only about 5% of their people in any one year have a major medical or surgical problem. So when Canadians come into Florida, as they do on a regular basis and spend several months with us, I always ask them, how's your health care? And they say, it's wonderful. You can go to the doctor, you don't have to pay them, everything else is paid, you can get your medicine free. And then I say, have you or any member of your family had any major medical or surgical problems? No, but it's there if we need it. Then you talk to the 5%. And they're the 5%. Well, the reason I'm down here is because they'll fix my gallbladder, but I got to wait 6 or 8 months. I happened for one of the, I get invited every once in a while by my former colleagues in world medicine to international meetings, and the last one was in Vancouver, British Columbia, roughly just about a year ago. And I got there shortly after the newspapers in Vancouver were reporting on people by name who were dying, who'd been on the waiting list for open heart surgery. It got so much that people were complaining, and they entered into a contract with two hospitals in Seattle, Washington, for the province of Vancouver to send down 200 patients who were on that waiting list. Now, when they get the quality of care is excellent. They've got good doctors, good hospitals. The quality is good, but, and I'm talking to the doctors, they say, look, I could replace X number of knees every month, but they only let me do so many under their global budgeting. I have to put other people who need it on the waiting list, and many await 6, 8, and 10 months.
Is that what's going to happen in the United States with perhaps somewhere down the road a single-payer system and more socialized medicine or not?
That's a danger that could happen.
Dr. Smith.
I think that, again, you don't repeat mistakes or problems in other systems. No, I'm not. I'm concerned
about... We got Social Security from Germany.
But you're missing the point here. When you've got a system that right now is not covering 39 million folks, 37 by other people's standards, 36 by others, 35, whatever figure you want, we've got a fundamental problem. Our biggest cost savings, by the way, which no one has raised, and I've made the point, is in administration. It is the single quickest way to get a cost savings to finance coverage for others. No one wants to bite that one. And again, the big problems in Canada, and by the way, the Canadians, our overbedding problem in Seattle and Buffalo, which was the other city, they paid Canadian rates. And you know how quick those American hospitals jump to it when it's even lower, but they're charging you higher rates? OHIP, Ontario Health Insurance Plan, negotiated Canadian dollar rates in Buffalo because of the backlog, which they realized they had, got the surgeries done because they got all those beds and the expensive care that you're paying for out of your premium and high costs.
I'm sure that's very true, but marginal revenue is different from average revenue, too, as you know from an economist standpoint. Dr. Annis, please, and I'm going to go to
Dr. Smith just reminded me when he said we have 37 million people who are not insured. However, every week on the highways of this country, we kill 800 people. Between 40 and 45,000 a year. They don't cost much, death is cheap. But we put into the hospital emergency rooms of this country every single week between 70 and 75,000 people. That's over 10,000 a day. The most recent report from hospitals like Parkland, and they have a National Association of these urban hospitals, 26% of all patients, of all ages, that were discharged from those hospitals, the average 26% were uncompensated by the individual who received the care. 37% of all emergencies that were taken care of were uncompensated. So the gunshot wounds, the stab wounds, the automobile accidents, they're all cared for. I agree they're not insured. But
and
because
not
they're not insured,
them.
That's correct. And that's why there's a big shift into the private sector. No question about it.
Okay, I'm going to shift into this guy.
I'm a physician. And you're a pediatrician. Uh-huh. In 1979, I saw a child who was 2 years old in Great Britain who was speech impaired because he couldn't have a tube placed in his ear. Uh-huh. This is not a complicated procedure. It couldn't be done because the regional health authority had a waiting list for ear, nose, and throat procedures. The second response I've seen of the federal government to vaccination, which you're involved in now, uh-huh. is 2 years ago in 1992, in order to give a DPT vaccination or a measles vaccine, we have to have the patient read a brochure from the Health and Human Services Department mm-hmm. that scares them to death. Then we have to explain to them that the vaccine is actually better for their child than all these horrible side effects. Mm-hmm. In 1993, we had a measles outbreak in Dallas.
That's right.
What scares me is that a federal answer to the problems that are being enunciated here would result in these same things. And this is not a financial issue. This is a care issue.
Well, you've accurately stated two issues that I think are worth responding to. Number one is the measles issue in Dallas. Let me now talk about it because we studied it deeply and I was here then. Number one is, what percentage of the children do you think that got measles had been in a doctor's office in the previous 6 months at a point in time in Dallas when they should have and could have been immunized? 96%. We talk about parental. We actually did an in-depth study. HMO data right now, and I agree with concerns there. Nationwide, immunization levels for two-year-olds, 51%. And this is not Medicaid HMO. We're not doing a good job in parents or providers in dealing with these issues. Also, the incentives are not there. Great Britain, let me tell another story, recently put a basically a bonus in of £1,000 in mid-80s to say if you achieve first 85%, you get your bonus. If you achieve 90%, you get a bonus. And this has continued. What are their immunization levels in Great Britain? A success story that you could adapt to the U.S. and reform is now they're hitting 95% where we're at 60%. There are aspects of these plans that you don't dismiss with sound bites. You pay attention to them, you adapt what's good. By the way, the story on the tubes, what do you think happened when I was in South Texas practicing in the Brownsville Community Health Center when no one would take my patients? Do you think I got tubes for them? I had to deal with antibiotics and other things or do it myself because no one would take them. So please come closer to home when you use these examples.
Thank you, Dr. Smith.
You're touching on the idea of the children and what percentage of children are have the availability of the free health care, the immunization shots and things like that, mm-hmm. but don't take advantage of it. And if it's a good percentage, what does any program that you're talking about do to address that need?
Sure. Very good question. Actually, again, getting back to the fact with Medicaid and the early periodic screening, diagnosis and testing, EPSDT immunizations, in Texas, as an example, we cover about a million two. There still are almost 2 million uninsured children that fall through the cracks that aren't picked up by all these other programs, a substantial number. They're in the middle class. They're lower middle class, again, working households, and not getting even these patchwork programs that are not ideal, because even with the Department of Health, we get funded by categories, this disease, not that disease, and they fall through the cracks. So the ones, the poorest of the poor, in fact, are being picked up through a number of these programs. The problem we're facing in states like Texas and across the South, by the way, is that these are lower middle class kids that are not getting these. And when you look at their immunization levels, they're poor. And that's why, in fact, the Shots Across Texas campaign in Texas is enrolling the private sector so they have a medical home, which is what they really need.
Okay, Dr. Ennis, and then I'm going to go to this gentleman and a couple more, and then I want to talk to you about what you want to tell us about solutions.
On my way here, I went by your University Medical Center. I've had the privilege of being here. Dr. Bill Ross, who is a head of family practice there for quite some time, I've spoken a number of times to his senior medical students just about the overall problems that doctors face today. But on the program with me was a physician attorney who also talked in terms of those problems. And one of the things that he shocked the students, because these are senior medical students, the entire student body, he shocked them one day and he said, you know, I never immunized children again, whooping cough, diphtheria, tetanus, measles, German measles, mumps or polio. And then he stopped and you could hear a pin drop in that auditorium, this doctor saying such a thing. He said, you know why? And then he reached in his pocket. He said, you know, I'm also an attorney. And he took out a little vial. He says, this is the vial of the immunization. It used to cost me $6 or $7. Now, because of my other profession, it costs, I think it was 60 some odd dollars. And he said, all that goes because of the abuses of the tort system and the fact that people who produce these vaccines, and many have gone out of the business, are sued. Under the law in Cook County, Chicago, the big county, by law, the children had to be immunized before they could go to school. A doctor up there immunized one youngster who got one of the encephalitis that occasionally, one out of a million cases will develop, one out of a certain percentage will develop, and they sued the doctor. Now, mind you, the law insisted that they be immunized. The vaccine that he used was made by a responsible pharmaceutical company. It was given like hundreds of other children was given, this one reaction, and yet the award against that doctor was $4.5 million. And that's why many of our pharmaceutical industries no longer produce children's vaccines. And it's another one of another problem that for another time, because
tonight wouldn't allow it. But it's one of those things that is part of the solution that you would see, and I think probably both of you would see, is some sort of reform of the tort system because of the incredible malpractice.
They like the system that it's much improved that they now have for the Vaccine Compensation Act, as long as it's kept funded, because in fact it does allow these companies to stay in business. By the way, the corollary is that 12 Dallas sites died from measles in 89-90, so let's take it to the other side. And the cost there, not just for the deaths, but for the hospitalization alone, not clinic visits, doctor visits, $3.6
million. That's right.
Thanks. I'd like to address this cost administration. You seem to think that because the cost administration in a social system is better than that of a free enterprise system, I'd like to say that, you know, if we could get rid of all advertising costs of any industry simply by socializing it and just saying, well, you have the choice of buying a Model T or nothing, and we don't have to advertise that. There are lots of costs that you could probably play with, and all government planners like to say, we're not going to produce this mistake or that mistake, and you come up with a brand new one you discover for us. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't need those discoveries from you or anybody else. I like the health care I have now, and I don't want to trade it.
Thank you. Let me get to the gentleman who's been very patient up here on the back row.
First of all, I'd like to let you know that I haven't had any insurance coverage for the last couple of years. This forces me to stay healthier, and I find that vitamin supplements seem to help a lot. Next thing I'd like to say is there's a congressman in Ohio by the name of Trafficant who said recently that currently our government is bankrupt and we're undergoing the biggest reorganization in modern history. Why do you want to trust the government with more tax money when they can't balance the books as it is now? I'm afraid all they're going to do is set up a bureaucracy, and it's going to be the good old boy spoil system, cronyism, coming down. And quite frankly, if I don't have a choice because I'm going to be involved in this system, I think that comes real close to slavery.
I have a question that goes to something Dr. Smith said, and that has to do with falling through the cracks and patients. I have a terminal neuromuscular disease, and I've been very well insured. At this time, I had to give up my job, and my insurance will not pay for the caregiving necessary to keep me going 24 hours a day. This is a hardship on the quality of life, the financial aspects of our life. I don't hear any answers among any of these programs regarding issues like mine or the other probably 10 million people with disabilities who could be more productive by having healthcare aids available with some kind of reimbursement. I don't need nursing. I'm dying. I'm not sick. What I need is someone to blow my nose. I don't hear anything. I hear talks of money. Who's going to pay for what? But my wife has to turn me over at night. My wife has to put my glasses up. She could be contributing to the household, but she can't because there is nothing available, payable either by insurance or the government. 98% of people like me are cared for by family and friends, and it's just not fair.
Dr. Annis, why don't you address that?
Well, the gentleman has a legitimate complaint, as do great numbers of Americans, and they are certainly in need of assistance. I agree with those that say once insurance is given, it should never be canceled for any reason, as long as they continue to pay their premium. Those unable to do so, then they need additional help. I think high-risk pools are a way, and much of it will have to be funded by government to take care of exactly the kind of case you're talking about. because it's this kind of hospice care that's so necessary, not only for people with your problems, but great number of other people with all kinds of both mental and physical problems.
I agree with you completely. Why does it seem that it's those kind of situations that that are just a tragic situations that I think most people watching this program would agree that there is a legitimate function there for government, and yet it's the money sort of goes someplace else. So Dr. Smith?
Well, actually, a couple of things here. We still keep use this word government and bureaucrats. It's fascinating, having been private sector and public and even elected official ones. You elect these folks, let me all remind you of that, and they set priorities in Austin and Washington. I have the chronically ill and disabled children's program. Most of my calls, you might think, are these high policy things. Most of my calls in my office are casework. It's an individual mom with a child that has cerebral palsy, with a feeding tube, in a wheelchair, and she wants to know about respite care. That's what I get called about. Despite what you think about the bureaucracy, that's what I deal with on most of my days. And you sit there and cry because you don't know what you're going to do because either the legislature, who you all elect, have given us either no money for these issues, don't think it's a priority, it's gone somewhere else. They don't want to deal with the administrative inefficiencies of having programs that are disease-oriented or 1,500 insurers. It's a problem. You're right. We don't also talk about in this reform debate mental health and dental health. We forgot the clavicles, folks. Everything above the clavicles has been left out. How could you respond to this? Actually, you don't need to create a new government agency. Why couldn't we have a single financer, being the government, but actually bid out and have competitive process to see who manages it? There's no reason. You're all in a paradigm and you're stuck, all of you, that think that it has to be a new agency. I started this program by saying, I'll get smaller. There are many ways to skin this cat. I'm not sure we've opened our horizons enough on this issue.
What would you do, Dr. Annis?
Well, I'm not in disagreement with Dr. Smith, but I couldn't help but think, and someone raised the question, the Social Security Administration twice in the last 6 months have made predictions. They will be bankrupt by the year 2000 or 2002. Why? Because Medicare continues to pay half of the cost of bills for a multimillionaire as well as for someone who really needs help. What we need is to quit paying for the multimillionaire and pay what it really costs to take care of people who have real problems, continuing, ongoing problems. These are problems that all of us through government can do a good job and give him enough money to take care of these problems. But instead, we're spreading it over everybody.
What would you do for the average person? How can we get out of this trap of increasing medical costs, increasing insurance costs, and then if it goes to some sort of a government system, increasing costs there too? How would you solve it? Give us one solution.
Well, of course, I think one of the good solutions came right from here in Dallas, Texas, the National Center for Policy Analysis. They have a policy that has all been demonstrated by the Forbes Corporation, by the Golden Rule Insurance Company, and by another one up in Indianapolis. I've forgotten the names. What they do is they urge their employees to take a low-cost, high-risk policy that will take care of major medical and surgical problems. They can get one for a $3,000 deductible for about $2,000 a year. Then you can put the other $2,500 of the $4,500 average that it costs for family coverage into a medical savings account. Now, when they have to go to the doctor or buy medicine or go to the dentist, they could take money out of that medical savings account. Most people in any 1 year don't have over $1,000, $1,500 in total costs other than that 5% that have the major problems. So for most people, it would continue to compound just like an IRA or a 401k program, and people would make the decision. It would be their money. If they change jobs, it's their insurance. They carry it with them, and that would get back to true insurance. And yet they would have this other money accumulating there, and it's not my idea. The Cato Foundation, the Heritage Foundation, the National Center for Policy Analysis, and other good, sound think tanks have said, put the decision back into the hands of the public. Give them the money, give them their own insurance, let them take it with you. I think ultimately that's a solution. Today, some 120 members of the Congress agree with us. That's not quite enough.
Okay, here's... We just happen to have someone from NCPA here. Dorman, would you like to address yourself quickly to that?
Yes, I'd like to find out how Dr. Smith feels about the solution that Dr. Annis outlined, where you have medical savings accounts and let people take care of their own health care, except for catastrophes, which insurance is really designed to take care of in the first place.
Well, I'm not going to dismiss them because I think we're going to have to try a couple of things to get folks covered, because I think we're going to end up with a piecemeal. I would challenge that you better evaluate it. One of my big concerns with this, by the way, is that we, and I've looked at the data and information on this, is you really do have some problems around the poor and the near poor. Yet you talk about how you will subsidize those. It's also not clear on the children's side where, when they don't work, that this is going to work. The costs, when you look at what is going to happen with the amount you'd have to put away and then disposable income to deal with apartments and foods and living conditions, you got a problem. It's too tight down there for those folks.
Let me tell you the problem we have. We're out of time. Great suggestions from you, Dr. Smith, Dr. Annis. Always a person I've met you, but great suggestions from you and in your book. I encourage both of you to keep up the work that you're doing. Hopefully we've looked at this debate in a little bit different way. You have heard excellent arguments about the philosophy and the politics of socialized medicine. Ultimately, you must make a decision. Do you believe that government should be more involved in healthcare and could provide better service at a lower cost? Or do you believe that the problem is too much government already and that more involvement would just make things worse? Either way, you can influence public policy. Your job is to get involved now. Our job is to help educate you on these issues. And as always, we've done it by talking about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.